Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast I'm introducing right now. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I don't need no nicknames.
Okay. And this week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing the new releases Free Guy, which is about a guy.
Indeed. It's about a character named Guy.
Neat.
And we'll get into that.
We've got Don't Breathe 2, not spelled T-O-O. Bit of a missed opportunity.
Should have been.
The new film Days, D-A-Y-S. The new film Raging Fire. And the new film Coda. They're all new films, I suppose.
We do review older films, but that's on different podcasts.
Different podcasts. Which, we ran a poll recently. And because we were talking about that show. And it's called The Streaming Club. But we accidentally called it Critically Reclaimed. On a recent podcast, and we asked if we should change the title.
We might have to change the title of that one, because that's too good an idea to pass up.
People like that title! We might have to do it. We might have to do it, but we have yet to make the final call. In any case, Whitney, you had a bit of a vacation. That's why we had a bit of a weird schedule the last week.
I did, yeah.
How you doing?
Thanks for your patience, dear listeners. Rested, thank you.
Good.
My family and I, we broadcast out of Los Angeles, and my family and I took a drive to Big Bear. The great thing about living in Southern California is you can drive 2 hours in any direction and have completely different
weather
biomes to exist in. So we were out on a lake in the woods, just 2 hours outside of LA.
Yeah.
And it was very nice.
It was very remote,
not a lot of people
around. Were you high enough that there was any snow, or was it just...
Well, I mean, we're going in August, so there wouldn't be snow anyway, but...
Okay, well, it depends. You can go, like, really,
but
really
there are,
tall.
There are ski slopes up there. During the summer, they turn the ski slopes into alpine slides. Which were a big part of my childhood. I loved alpine slides.
That's fun.
Did you ever go on an alpine slide?
No, I have no idea what you're talking about.
They're a big, like, wide concrete half pipes, and you get on these, like, they're sort
like
of
an
like
inner
a,
tube or something?
It's not an inner, it's sort of like a skateboard. It's got wheels on the bottom, but it's got this big sort of fiberglass thing you sit in, and a little handle in the middle.
Oh.
And that's your brake, and that's the only means of control you
Does
have.
Does it actually work, that brake? Could you, like, stop on a dime? Or?
Oh, goodness, no. It's incredibly dangerous, and you'd get scraped up, and you'd fly off the track. Yeah, it was wonderful, dangerous childhood rite of passage.
Yeah, that's a hard pass for me. No, thank you. Yeah, but I'm glad you had fun. Mm.
Somebody out there knows what I'm talking about when I'm describing alpine slides.
Yeah, Whitney left me in L.A. to work, and you know what? Maybe I'll take a couple of days off. People have been telling me I should.
Yeah.
We took a short vacation in June, but it was a work vacation. We were doing research for a project.
So it wasn't really a vacation.
No, but I think I might need to take a few days off in the nearest future. And some people were just like, hey, you could just, like, not post podcasts. I'm like, that's crazy talk.
Wait, what? What are you talking about?
But what we may do is maybe for a few days or a week, we might post some classic episodes and maybe even unlock some of our Patreon content if
there
we do
go.
That. That way we can have some new stuff for people, or at least, you know, must-see TV. If you haven't seen it, it's new to you kind of vibes. But anyway, we'll cross that bridge when we get there. But that's neither here nor there. You're not here to listen to us talk shop. You're here to listen to us talk movies. I hope. Because if you're here to listen to us talk shop, that is over, because we got to review some films. This is another one of those weird weeks where neither of us saw the same things.
No, so we'll be taking turns.
Yeah. Let's start with the movie that ended up being the biggest film of the weekend, at least at the box office, as far as that's concerned. And this is a film that I've seen advertised since the dawn of time.
This is one of those films that, they were advertising for a long time.
It was supposed to come out, like, right around the time of the quarantine hit, and then just kept getting pushed.
Pushed it back.
Yeah. So I've been seeing it advertised for at least a solid year and a half, 2 years. It's called Free Guy.
Free Guy is the latest film from director Sean Levy. Sean Levy is one of those sort of Hollywood workmen who will just sort of take the job, but will occasionally come out with something that's actually a little bit notable.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Levy directed the remake of The Pink Panther, which is pretty good, actually.
Especially considering how many of the later Pink Panther movies really lowered the bar.
Yeah, I mean,
like, the last three or four Pink Panther movies.
At least 2/3 of those movies are just abysmal. There's like 3 or 4 good ones.
Yeah, but that first Steve Martin movie, the second one's got some funny jokes, but that first one's quite funny.
It's a solid film.
Yeah.
Sean Levy also did films like This Is Where I Leave You and
The Internship,
Big Fat Liar, Cheaper by the Dozen. I haven't seen the Night at the Museum films. I've heard they're quite good, but I don't know.
The Cheaper by the Dozen phenomenon really weirds me out because now they're like, I hear they're like rebooting it and
again?
They're changing the plot around. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, it was a biopic, right? The original Cheaper by the Dozen was about an actual family and how they, like, the dad was like this expert in, like, efficiency expert.
Okay.
And he would go around the world, like, giving lectures on, like, how to, like, improve efficiency and how to live a very structured life. While his own life, he had a dozen kids, and that leads to a lot of chaos, and it's actually a really good movie. And I'm like, you remade it and you set it in the present day. Has there ever been a biopic that was rebooted into a new timeline with a totally different cast? I've never seen that before.
That's actually a good question if they've like updated a biopic like that.
Yeah, I guess young Einstein kind of, but like that's like the only one I can think of.
Sean Levy also directed a really fun Amblin-esque science fiction film called Real Steel.
Yeah.
Which is about Rock'em Sock'em. It was essentially Rock'em Sock'em Robots, the movie, about a little kid who comes into possession of a sparring robot, because in the future this is the most popular sport, is boxing robots. Uh-huh. And you can put on, like, match movement suits to control the robots. It's very video game-like. Yeah. It's light, it's silly, it doesn't really deal with, like, questions of AI, which it kind of brushes up very gently against.
The implication is that if this had turned into a franchise, they would have gone there, but they're not. One of the things I like about that movie is it's not super concerned with world building. The pieces are there if they want to pick them up later, but it tells its own story, and it's a story about a has-been robot fighter who bonds with his son over a junky robot that happens to keep winning these boxing matches, and it's this underdog robot. That's a good movie. I will go to bat for that movie. I know some people are like, yeah, the original story is a lot more hardcore. I don't give a shit. This adaptation is its own thing, and it's a blast. Mm-hmm. And if that's one of those movies, if that movie came out in 1985, people would be in love with that movie.
Well,
people would have action figures of that movie. There'd be Funko Pops. It'd be getting rebooted with Hugh Jackman.
I called it Amblin-esque. It's clearly like a throwback to that sort of 80s era of playful Spielbergian science fiction.
Right. But you're right. Like, and he makes all of these comedies, which are hit and miss, and then he just knocked that sci-fi thing out of the park.
He should stick with that because Free Guy is also pretty good.
Nice.
It is also kind of Amblin-esque. It's light and playful. It brushes gently against sort of deeper concepts, almost frustratingly so. And it's, pretty
frustrating
fun.
That it does, or frustrating that it doesn't do it enough?
It doesn't do it enough. So we open in a place called Free City, where everybody in sunglasses is just a super badass who blows up buildings and steals cars and does whatever they want. And Guy, played by Ryan Reynolds, is a guy in a blue shirt who works at a bank that is held up 3 times a day.
Right.
And the world is constantly exploding in violence, but he's actually very upbeat. It's very much like the Lego movie in that regard.
I got that vibe from the trailer every time he's walking around the thing, and he's like, everything is awesome today, and I'm just going to get dragged into a storyline even though I'm just like a cog in the machine.
Yeah. It turns out he is a literal cog in a machine. Mm. Guy is an NPC. In a broad, massive multiplayer online video game. And when we cut out to the real world, we find that there are the designer, played by Taika Waititi, is trying to figure out what's going on with this glitching AI. Now, as it turns out, Guy is developing his own, very slowly developing his own consciousness.
Mm-hmm. NPC, by the way, stands for non-player
character.
Any character in a video game you can't control, that's an NPC. Mm-hmm. They're controlled by whoever programmed the game.
And as it turns out, this Guy character is part of some broader scheme out in the real world to steal somebody else's constructed AI program and layered into Free City. Mm-hmm. And so there's all this shenanigans going on in the real world about these two programmers, one of whom is played by Future Star. Mm. Let me look up her name. Jodie Comer is her name, and she is...
I think she's already a TV star.
Okay.
I think she's on Killing Eve. That movie, that show's huge.
She's great in this. Okay. She because she plays a character named Molotov Girl in the game, and then somebody very different in the real world, and she plays both parts incredibly well. She just has a lot of presence and a lot of confidence. And Guy sees Molotov Girl, and that's the sort of thing that sparks off his breaking from the routine and starting to grow. And she explains to him that she, thinking that he's a real person, thinks he needs to level up in the game before he can help her do her story.
Mm-hmm.
And he decides to level up in the game by not committing crimes, by, like, helping people and stealing their guns and returning money, and that gets him leveling up in the game.
There's a term for that. It's like called a pacifist run or something like that. Like, can you beat Fallout 4 without hurting anybody?
Right.
Which it's is possible, another, but really hard.
It's another challenge you can add to the video game.
Yeah.
The plots continue to thicken, and it all ends up as a race against the clock to find some hidden code within the video game as the video game is being rewritten around them. Mm-hmm. And Guy begins talking to the other NPCs in the game, and they also start developing their own consciousnesses.
So it's like a little bit of Tron Legacy, a little bit of Loading Ready Run. Ready Player One.
A little bit of Tron Legacy, a little bit of Lego Movie. Ryan Reynolds is a charming AF, and he carries this movie a great deal of the way because Guy is such this like unbearably optimistic character, and he's just fun to watch. And Ryan Reynolds has a little bit of his usual sardonic tone that carries it along a lot. It is frustrating though, because this is dealing with some pretty big ideas in terms of like the origin of artificial consciousness, what the actual moral implications of that might be. Where it's coming from, how video games are being used as this new means of creating life. And they don't go into the Star Trek questions, unfortunately, where they talk about, emergent properties and all the rest. It's more just a fun adventure flick.
It can be fun for a movie to ask those questions and let the audience deal with it.
Mm.
It looks something like Total Recall, where it like addresses the ideas, but it never actually comes down hard on them and lets you draw your own conclusions.
There are several scenes devoted to, what is this? Is this reality? And then it ends on a very ambiguous note, Total Recall.
Yeah.
As to, what reality are we standing at the end of the movie?
They don't make
that 100% clear in that film. And I appreciate that. This is a little bit more of a kid-friendly version.
Right.
There are appearances by some real life like YouTubers who kids would know, but I wouldn't. Like the people who comment on video games for a living.
I know a few of those people, but I gotta tell you, that's one of those things where I'm starting to feel really old. YouTube celebrities, and I saw like this last New Year's, but they didn't really have like a good ball drop, because of the quarantine. So we watched like the YouTube like countdown to maybe we threw it on, and it was like, oh, and here's this awesome celebrity who's got like a billion followers, and I'm like, I don't know who that is. They seem 21 years old and with it, and I don't
see Chewy 48.
I'm starting to just get really pushed outside of the pop culture bubble, and. Honestly, I'm kind of fine with it.
I'm fine with it as well.
That's part of it. You can't stay on top of that shit forever. You're gonna fall by the wayside. Audience, if you're listening to us and you're smirking at us, it will happen to you sooner or later. It might be not the exact same year or whatever like that in your life, but eventually, in like your 30s somewhere, 40 at latest, you're gonna realize that there's just all this new shit, and you can catch up to it and you can find out all about it, but it's not yours anymore.
It's just not yours. It's one of the reasons why I'm often feel quite pessimistic about the future of cinema, because the future of entertainment, I live with a 6-year-old and his entertainment is those YouTubers who talk about video games. That's all he ever wants to watch. I try putting movies on and he turns them off. He doesn't like them.
For me, that just feels so cyclical. I feel like a lot of what like YouTube television is now, when people are watching this, it's a lot of didactic stuff. People talking to the camera, interacting, like, hey guys, that kind of thing. Like, kind of like we do. But I feel like that was what TV was more like in the 50s. And, yeah, and even, watch, and even the way like they do like product placement now, it's like today's episode is brought to you by SmackDown Cola or whatever the hell you're talking about. That's what they used to do in the 50s. TV evolved. People got bored with it after a while. They got more ambitious and they got more narrative driven and it got a little less just people talking at a desk. And I feel like that's bound to happen eventually. We're just going to move in a cycle.
We'll see. We'll see where the future leaves us. But as it stands, this is very much trying to pander to the kiddies by including a lot of like YouTube sensations. There's a cameo by Terry Schwartz, who I used to work for at IGN.
Oh, that's cool.
She's moved on to a bigger and better things. Yeah. But yeah,
she's amazing. She has a
cameo in Free Guy. And yeah, this is all like trying to address video game language in a much more mainstream cinematic sort of way. Mm-hmm. Although it does take place in a world where A, YouTube celebrities are bigger than movie stars. And so many people become involved, like the whole world becomes involved in the fate of Guy, the Guy character. And there's those sort of montages of like clips from around the world of people watching things on screens just to show that it's a worldwide phenomenon. So here's a tiny village in Malaysia and they're all watching Ryan Reynolds like play this video game. And I'm not sure if like YouTube videos have reached that level of penetration to the point where it's being projected on the screen
Is there anything in New York in it for anybody else? Like, is if Guy wins, this is a good thing for the world, or at least gamers,
there are definitely some stakes, and I feel it takes a pretty deft touch, especially in this age of increased artificial intelligence and our comfort with machines, to develop sympathy for like a robot or an artificial character.
Yeah.
And I feel like this film does that. It makes us know that, lets us feel that this thing is alive.
Which is good. I think that's a good idea. I played a lot of video games and like I often like, I see people like just be really horrible and abusive and like Grand Theft Auto. And I'm just like, that's a person crossing the street. I don't just want to beat them up indiscriminately.
That's some people's outlet, I suppose.
Whether or not that's
healthy is still being debated.
I like the idea of taking these characters who people just don't think twice about and making them the center stage. I think that's a good idea for a movie.
There are a lot of references that I clearly did not get. They're making references to video games that I'm not familiar with or do not play. I don't play online games.
Anything specific that came up that you were just like, say something about Warcraft or
they refer
Eve Online or whatever. I think
that might have been mentioned. They make reference to certain games that I'm not familiar with.
Okay, just curious.
But even as an outsider, I understood the world they were setting up and what was at stake within the game, and that the game is important to the people in this world. Right at the end, they do this really horrendously baffling thing, which seems to have been a late addition by the Disney purchase, because this was made by Fox and was swept up in the Fox buyout.
Right.
And so Disney released it under 20th Century Studios.
It's just left over. Disney didn't make it, but now it's in there. Or they didn't initially plan it anyway.
And then during a vital point in the movie, they make some pretty open references to like Avengers and Star Wars movies, and it's death. It's like, this is supposed to be like really kind of exciting and clever, and this film has had a little bit of wit and a twinge of intelligence up until this point, and at that point it's just, you're just gonna pander. There's a minute where it's just they're gonna do nothing but pander.
I'm curious, because once it hit that point, it sounds a lot like Ralph Breaks the Internet, which I actually quite like that movie. I think that movie does a lot of really clever things with the internet, online gaming, etc. And there's a gag where they meet, like, they go to, like, the Disney hub of the internet.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of stormtroopers there, and they meet all the Disney princesses, and it's a digression. I find it amusing, but it is a digression. Does it play differently than that, or is it basically more of that?
No, it's just as insufferable as that.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't like that portion of Ralph Breaks the Internet, because it was clearly just Disney scratching its own back in front of me. It's like, I don't need to see you do that. You do that all the time. Do something witty.
Okay.
Those Ralph movies are actually like kind of interesting and funny and different than a lot of what they do.
Yeah. So in the end, Free Guy, Good movie.
Free Guy. Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. Okay.
Franchise? Do you think they'll make more of these, or do you think that I'm asking if it feels like they're setting it up? Does it feel like that, or does it feel like a done in one kind of vibe?
No, there's already been talk of making more. This was
Freer Guy.
Free. They'll just call it Free Guy too.
Damn it.
My pitch set it 400 years after the events of the first film.
Nice.
This film, I read an article like just on the way over here that this film has made more money at the box office than any other film since like the reopening of theaters.
I think maybe Fast and Furious. I think they're that is
original.
Original IP.
All the sequels and remakes have been making plenty of money, but this is a pretty big deal in terms of like original ideas go. So, and knowing the way Hollywood tends to operate, sure, they're gonna put a stool down next to it and start milking.
I'm honestly just happy that's something that it's obviously a bit derivative, and there've been other things kind of like it, but I just like that there is something that isn't just a sequel or just a nostalgia cash in that is hitting. And I know everyone's looking at the box office like, oh, there's something horribly wrong. Yeah, a fucking pandemic.
Well, and
every single box office like article has a giant asterisk next to it right now, because I see a lot of people trying to like disseminate or discern or try to analyze the box office like it's business as usual right now. It's not. It's just not. Suicide Squad isn't doing great. Yeah, it's on HBO Max. Okay, people are seeing it at home.
The frustrating thing about the conversation is people tend to refer to certain films as being, well, it's the pandemic, it's an aberration, and other films as whatever, that was going to fail anyway. And this idea that certain films are destined to succeed or fail, it feels like a fallacy to me.
That's your narrative that you're projecting onto it. The Suicide Squad,
people are being very forgiving about that. Oh, it's a pandemic. Well, you should qualify every statement about the Suicide Squad. Nobody said anything like that about In the Heights, which
they were like, "Oh, I guess people don't want this."
Now they're just saying people. Well, clearly, people weren't going to see that anyway. They're both failing. They're all bombs.
Yeah,
every film that's coming out right now is a bomb.
Every film they were all meant to make more money than this.
Films are too expensive. I mean, Free Guy, you know, considered like quote a lesser release, would still cost $150 million to make, and How much do you think Black Widow costs? Like $300
Probably at least $200. Probably more when you factor in all the advertising especially when they advertise it twice. That sucks.
The big problem with something like Black Widow is that it fits into like this larger series that they're making.
Uh-huh.
So they have to release this before they release other things. Yeah. So they can't like rework it around.
I think they had to like reshoot or add another scene or something to the Falcon and the Winter Soldier TV series, because Black Widow was supposed to have already come out and it was supposed to introduce a character who would show up on that show, but now they made their first appearance in that show, so they had to like rework that a little bit.
So they were in kind of in a rush. They couldn't sit on that one a lot longer. A lot of films, who knows what the studio is thinking when they want to release it a certain way and not another. The point is, all the studios are taking a bath on all of these.
Pretty much.
They are all failing, essentially. Mm-hmm. They are all losing money.
Pretty much.
So trying to say that the Suicide Squad would have done better, whatever. We can make speculate all we like.
That's not where we are.
The Suicide Squad lost money. Free Guy lost money. All of these movies are losing money. It doesn't matter if they have vaguely impressive opening weekends.
I will say this
we're
right now.
We're not at the kind of level that they were designed to be.
If Free Guy had come out when it was supposed to come out, it would have made less.
I think you're right. I think it would have tanked.
Now where they have to put it out now. They have to put it out there or never put it out, basically, at this point. So they're putting it out.
The weird thing about the pandemic and this limited release schedule and all of these films losing money is we're getting a weirdly more diverse sort of film landscape.
Yeah.
Where
different giant blockbusters every week. It's maybe one. And then, like, a bunch of, like, weird genre, which actually gives a good segue to the next film we're reviewing. Don't Breathe 2, which is a sequel to the 2016 Fede Alvarez film Don't Breathe, which...
A wonderfully nasty little piece of work.
That's a fucked up movie. And it's a movie that knows
it. I liked
it
a lot, yeah.
It's a movie that knows it. I know that movie takes some really, really harsh and dark turns. that some people, it doesn't, I wouldn't say it breaks the contract with the audience because it's already a fucked up movie, but it gets way more fucked up in the second half than you were ready for. And some people it turns off, but for me, it's like, yeah, it's dark, it's unpleasant, it's never saying it is pleasant, it's a thoroughly nasty motion picture, and I think it's a very effective one.
Yeah, absolutely, and, you know, it's... It doesn't have any sort of supernatural elements, but it has horror elements, and I would call it a horror movie.
Oh, it's definitely a horror movie. Yeah, it's terrifying.
That first one took place in Detroit in an abandoned neighborhood. There was only one house that was unabandoned in this neighborhood.
Yeah.
Some enterprising house thieves break into the house, hoping to rob it. The blind old man who lives there.
The thieves are a bunch of teenagers who are just trying to get enough money to get out of this horrible dying town and make something of themselves. So there's something, they're doing the wrong thing, but they're not like evil.
Yeah.
They're doing it
for sympathetic reasons.
Yeah, and so when they find out this old man has a lot of money because like his daughter had been killed in a car accident,
he got a big settlement. Yeah.
Yeah. So and he's keeping it, and he's keeping it in cash on the premises somewhere. So they break in to steal it, and then they find out that he's an ex-Navy SEAL who has something to hide, and he will murder the shit out of them. And it turns into like they're almost like. It's almost like they're trapped in a house with a minotaur. Like, it's a really...
It is very labyrinthine, so that's a good...
It's a lot of bravura filmmaking. Fede Alvarez really knows how to set the stage and, like, set up all of these visual elements and geography. They'll be really important later, but you'll know where everything is and where all, like, the tools of violence are gonna be. And a lot of twists and turns in it. And it's a very, very effective, but extremely malevolent, arguably malignant shocker. But it's very, very good. The sequel, Don't Breathe 2, also from the same writers. It's written by Fede Alvarez and, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Rodo Sayages. But this time, Rodo Sayages is directing.
Okay.
So at the very least, it's like keeping it like in the... It's not like it's completely changed hands and someone's going to take this a totally new direction. It is 8 years after the events of the first film. Which is weird, because that was only 5 years ago, and I thought it was taking place in the present, so I don't know where we are anymore. It's one of those things like where Child's Play 3 came out 1 year after Child's Play 2.
Andy was like, the main character, is like something like a decade older.
So now all of a sudden we're in the early 2000s, and we're just not going to talk about that. That happens with the Friday the 13th movies as well, because characters start aging really, really fast, and like by the time you hit like Jason Goes to Hell, I'm pretty sure it's supposed to take place in like 2010. Like, it's super fucking weird. But I digress.
Somebody did the math on the TV series 24, because each season had a new president.
Yeah.
So they had to sort of, like, fast forward through presidential terms. Yeah. So by the time they get to last season,
the president, doesn't make it through the president doesn't make it through their whole term because of events that happen in the series. So maybe it's not that bad, but it's still a ridiculous amount of time. Kiefer Sutherland should have been played by Donald Sutherland in the last season.
Oh, that would have been really great.
Funny. But I digress. So it's 8 years after the original film. And the villain of the film, character played by Stephen Lang, his name is Nordstrom.
Who was in Avatar?
He was in Avatar. He was the original Freddy Lowndes in Manhunter. He's been around for a long, long time, and he's great. He's a really scary presence. He has a new daughter. She is, I think, 10 or 11. She is played by. Oh, hold on, I have the wrong. Don't Breathe. Up.
You called up a little.
I brought up the page so I could get the cast right, and I accidentally brought up Don't Breathe 1. His new daughter is named Phoenix. She's played by an actress named Madeline Grace. He's teaching her survival skills, and he doesn't let her out very much. Turns out, skulking around the back alleys of Detroit, organ harvesters. Oh, yes. We have rogue organ harvesters. They're kidnapping people. They're taking their organs. They're doing a whole bunch of bad stuff.
Go on.
A bunch of guys break into their house. They're trying to kidnap the little girl. They don't know that they've broken into the wrong house because Stephen Lang starts fucking them up real bad. And then, I don't really want to like go into all of the twists here, but I will say this. There's at least one twist here that I didn't see coming. And it does kind of recontextualize the film quite a bit. But there are some big reversals. The way that, you know, the organ harvesting thing kind of feels like a red herring for a while, or maybe it is the most important plot point, or maybe it's something else entirely is going on. But basically what happens is the little girl gets kidnapped, and now it's up to Stephen Lang to save her. Here's the problem. If you've seen the original Don't Breathe, Stephen Lang is an unforgivable monster.
Yeah, he does some really nasty things.
Yeah, this isn't like Godzilla, who's just being a giant lizard, and you can kind of forgive Godzilla for, like, just being a giant lizard. It doesn't really have, like, plans or anything like that. Stephen Lang in the original movie, not this character, not the guy. I'm sure Stephen Lang is very nice.
He plays heavies a lot.
This villain Nordstrom, this villain that he plays, did something. It wasn't like a snap decision. They made a conscious, horrifying, evil decision to do horrifying, evil things, which I will not recount here and ruin your day if you don't know what they are. If you've seen the movie, you know what they are, and you know that there are things we can forgive. There are things we can overlook. There are also times when you can put, like, two bad guys in a movie, but one bad guy is demonstrably worse.
Uh-huh.
For example, Don't Breathe, where the protagonists are breaking and entering and stealing things. Those are not, quote-unquote, good guys. But Stephen Lang is so much worse that you can have sympathy for those poor thieves.
Mm.
Here, he might not be doing the most horrible things in this movie, but it takes place after the events of the first movie. We know he's already done them. And the movie is doing what it can to not pretend that those things didn't happen, but to suggest that maybe redemption is possible for this guy.
Mm.
And at no point does the movie actually make a compelling case for that, which is frustrating. And I feel like as though they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. They want him to be this kind of horrible anti-hero, but they also want to acknowledge that he's a monster. And they never find a good balance.
Okay.
There's
a way to do that. But yeah.
There is, but I don't know for this guy.
Maybe
I really
don't.
Based on what he's done, I honestly don't think, you know, he can try, but I don't think he's ever going to win us back. So
I grew up during the golden age of slashers, so the idea of a horror series following the killer over his victims is par for the course, as far as I'm concerned.
And every once in a while, they'll actually turn, like, a villain into some kind of anti-hero. It's uncommon.
Yeah,
but it's
what happened in the Puppet Master series. After a while, those puppets became, like, defenders of humanity rather than against even more evil puppets.
Godzilla's another good example right there. The original Gojira is a horror movie about a metaphor for nuclear devastation.
They never did that with, like, Michael Myers or Jason Voorhees.
No, Jason Voorhees kind of in Freddy versus Jason, because compared to Jason, Freddy is more evil.
Yeah.
So, in the end, Jason does... He's not a good guy, but you are kind of rooting for Jason in that final fight.
Are you?
I am.
Okay.
I am. Jason
murder a bunch of people in that movie.
Jason feels like a force of nature. Okay. Jason is a child who was failed by the adults and the at least the mature people in his life and became this force of nature. Jason is a tragic tale.
Okay.
Jason should not have been turned into that. Sad. Whereas Freddy Krueger chose to be what he is. And he continues to be what he is, and he is making very conscious decisions to be evil, and he doesn't have to. So for me, I think Jason is clearly the villain of his own franchise, but put them next to each other, Freddy is worse.
I suppose so.
So this is kind of that situation here.
I guess, but if they had made maybe a few more sequels before they tried to go the anti-hero route, maybe it would be a little bit more palatable.
Yeah, like Freddy, they made Freddy funny. You couldn't do that in Freddy Krueger 2, because in the first one, we know he's a child murderer.
Well, those are going more for scares.
Yeah.
Later on, A Nightmare on Elm Street series is just wild. They're, like, amazingly creative.
Yeah.
In
a good way, I think they're all over the place. Even the worst even the worst Nightmare on Elm Street movie is still fun, at least until you get to the remake.
Yeah, A Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5 is, like, has a lot of weird imaginative stuff and, like, almost no story whatsoever. I can't even follow that movie.
That movie, like, 3 or 4 times. I have no idea what happens in it. Yeah. I could not tell you the plot of that movie for the life of me. I have no idea.
Like, I don't think there really is one.
No, I don't think there is.
But it was directed by Stephen Hopkins, who went on to do, like, bigger Hollywood project.
Mm. So was that one Stephen Hopkins? Which one? Rennie Harlan did four.
Rennie Harlan did four.
Four. That's okay. I mixed them up.
Yeah,
okay.
Chuck Russell did three. Okay. Like
you can tell Chuck Russell did three.
Yeah, they're just the amount of talent. Like they got really interesting directors to make those Friday.
Yeah,
the 13th.
Rachel Talalay, Jack Talalay Shoulder
did number six. Yeah. Yeah, Jack Shoulder did two. Yeah. And yeah, Wes Craven did one and seven. Who directed any of the Jason films? Well, those are
Steve Miner.
Those are like Sean Cunningham's babies.
Ronnie Yu did Freddy vs. Jason. He's a prominent filmmaker. But yeah, the Jason movies, the director's a little bit more disposable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Sean Cunningham is the executive producer of that series. So can the killer from... I mean, Don't Breathe, he was such a monster.
Yeah.
Not just in what he did, but the way he was depicted, the way he skulked around, and how carefully they kept the camera away from him, tried to not make... Like, at first, he was presented as, like, sympathetic.
Yeah.
But then they did the big twist. They turned the tables on the home invaders. It turns out he's this horrible killer with, like, army training.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't come across as admirable at all.
Yeah.
So it's a little curious. Maybe there is a contingent of this film that... admires the character in this weird sort of way.
I'm watching this movie and like there's parts of it that work. There's some good cinematography in here. All the actors are doing the best they can with the material. There's stuff that fails miserably. The logic in this movie is out the door. There's this one bit in the movie where there's a bunch of meth dealers and a lot of the plot revolves around these characters and their motivation is they're trying to deal more meth and they're going to these horrific and unreasonable lengths for the sake of one person. And the justification is, well, that person cooks our meth, so we have to do everything to keep them around or else we have no business. Mm. And I'm like, I've seen everything you've had to do over the course of this movie. There are other meth dealers. There are other people who can cook meth. When you think about all of the people who cook meth... it can't be that hard to find someone who can cook meth. For the love of God, you are making it way too complicated. Like, eight of you have died today because you're committed to this meth cook. Come on! Get another meth cook! Like, there's a lot of, like, things like that just don't track.
You're describing something that could feel like a good chunk of sleazy fun.
I know, it's not fun, though. There's nothing... The original wasn't fun, either. Mm. It was entertaining, but it wasn't fun.
Yeah.
It was intense. This is going for that kind of the same thing, except now there's, like, a child in peril, too, so that adds this other layer of, like, discomfort to it. Where was I going with this? But I'm watching this movie, and I'm thinking to myself, this is from the same people. This isn't like someone jumping onto the series and trying to turn it into something else, which has happened many times before in horror. This is the original writers.
Hmm.
One of the writers is now directing. It feels as though... It's almost as though they're trying to, like, purge this character from their system.
Hmm.
Like, we created this horrible monster, and... maybe we overdid it because now we can't turn it into a franchise where he's the hero. And I'm like, did it ever occur to you to just make the franchise with him as the villain? Like, you could just keep him as the villain.
Like some saps break into wherever he is in this movie.
There's a million different things you could do. He travels or something or whatever. Like there's other stuff you could do here where he's still the bad guy. And it feels like they're trying to redeem the character in some way without... pretending he isn't what he is. And unfortunately, they don't make a convincing case. They don't make a good argument. There's some cool bits in this, but the whole premise of the movie is now this guy's the protagonist and I want him to fail. I don't want the little girl to end up with the other monstrous kidnappers, but like I don't want like this guy to be like forgiven for what he's done. I don't want that. At no point do I feel like he's earned that. It feels like, and he doesn't, and it's not like it ends with him going, ha ha, I got away with everything and now everyone loves me. And like, it's not like that kind of weird Wayne's World mecha happy ending. But it does feel like the filmmakers are pretty eager to try to find a way to let this guy off the hook or at least forgive him or, you know, heal this part of their soul. And it's not convincing.
Well,
at all.
The only way to redeem him is you put him up against somebody who's even worse.
Yeah.
Like, that they have them do battle and you cheer for him as he kills off some other even more horrible
And I
person.
Feel like that's what they were trying to do, but they failed. Because ultimately, and I, in order to explain this, I'd have to go into more detail, but spoilery detail, and I don't want to ruin it for you, but ultimately, if you look at what the new bad guys are doing and what Stephen Lang did in the first film, there's a lot of parallels.
Okay.
They're not that different.
Okay.
So it's not like one of them is worse than the other. It's just everyone's shit.
Well,
so, like, I guess if you just committed to that and just made it, like, completely irresponsible. Mm-hmm. Like, if you'd done, like, the Devil's Rejects, where everyone's just horrible and they're unapologetic about it, and that's just the universe we live in, I think maybe you could have gotten away with that. Is it, like, irresponsible fun? Is it responsible fun filmmaking? No, it's irresponsible filmmaking. But it could at least be consistent within itself and could maybe be effective. But yeah, Don't Breathe 2 is I don't think it's good. I don't think it's a good movie. It's not devoid of good bits, but it doesn't work. And that's very disappointing. Tell me about... what did we do? Tell me about Coda. Let's do that next.
Okay, I don't want to... You want to talk about Simon Lang yet? Okay.
No. Let's save it for last.
Okay.
I feel like we're doing the big stuff at the front, and Coda, people have been talking about that since Sundance, where it won a bunch of awards.
Yeah, it won a bunch of awards at Sundance. Coda is it's a remake of a film called Les Familles Béliers, which is a French film.
Okay. I don't know.
Coda stands for Child of Deaf Adults, CODA, and it is about a young woman. She's a senior in high school. She's played by Emilia Jones. Emilia Jones is amazing in this film, and keep an eye on Emilia Jones. And she works it, for her parents. Her father and her older brother are fishermen. They live in Massachusetts, and her mom helps out with the business as well. And things are really, really bad for fishermen right now. They have to sell their fish to intermediaries before they go to market. Mm. So, and the intermediaries are underbidding them all the time, and they're getting less and less money for their fish. So she being the only one who can interpret her father's and her brother's sign, has become an integral part of the family business of fishing.
Right.
Her true passion, irony of ironies, is singing. She has a passion for music. She loves listening to music, and she catches the eye of her music teacher, who's played by Eugenio Derbez.
Okay.
He's a pretty fun actor. And he is encouraging her to not just audition for the school plays, but to start applying for scholarships and going to arts college.
Yeah.
She's good enough to go to arts college. She's on the cusp of making a very big decision in her life. Does she pursue her dream of singing, a dream that her parents are incapable of understanding to her eyes, or does she give up on her own dream and help out with the family business, and things continue apace in that she gets closer and closer to realizing her dream. Eugenio Derbez begins teaching her more and more, while meanwhile her father finally stands up to these people who have been underbidding all of these fisheries, and he decides to start a fisherman's co-op for all of the fishermen who live in this little town. The father is played by Troy Kotsur, deaf actor. He is amazingly funny in this movie. There are all kinds of family scenes where they're just gathered around a dinner table, joshing each other and insulting each other and making jokes, but it's all in sign, achieved with subtitles. That's wonderful. And that they're able to express so much, just in sign and acting, is really kind of beautiful and engaging in a way that a dialogue scene wouldn't be.
And it's weird that we even have to make note of that, because of course it would be.
Yeah.
But these are conversations that we're not privy to on camera often enough. Mm. This is just not an environment that most movies visit, which sucks. Mm. I haven't seen this movie yet. I've heard good things, but I do know of it, and that's the thing. One of the things I hope is works well. I'm glad to hear it works well.
Here it works well. This is a really good film about sort of the family dynamic and the way the family gets along. All four of the main family characters, not just the Emilia Jones and Troy Kotsur, but Marley Matlin, who plays Mom, and the actor who plays the brother, I think his name is Daniel Durant. All four of them together have this really wonderful dynamic, and you get this really wonderful idea that they've grown up together and they have been a family. They didn't just meet on set that morning. And after a while, you become so involved in their family dynamic that even tiny gestures begin to have gigantic emotional punches. There's a lot of really kind of melodramatic beats, of course, you know, racing to a certain location to get somewhere just on time, parents having a change of heart at just the right moment, that sort of thing that you see in you know, very typical kind of Hollywood melodramatic screenplays. But here, they work. They work so unbelievably well, to the point where, you know, you're kind of like clutching your chest and reaching for the hankies. It's like, this is kind of beautiful. This is really intense and gorgeous in a way that all Hollywood melodramas ought to be. This is the kind of thing that should come easy and rarely does. And it's actually so refreshing to finally see it done well every once in a while.
Yeah, we take it for granted, this kind of, like, is it melodrama? Mm. I take that for granted a lot because it's so easy to do badly and so many people get away with doing it badly or mediocrely. But yeah, every once in a while you see a movie that comes along and reminds you that maybe there's a formula to this, but the formula works for a reason.
Yeah.
And if you just put something, like, really earnest into it, you can get something really great. That's really cool, man.
Yeah, I really, really, really highly recommend this one. Okay. It's on Apple TV Plus. It debuted at Sundance. I don't think it's in theaters.
I think it's just Apple TV Plus. It's right just now. Apple TV Plus. I imagine they're probably doing some kind of, like, Oscar consideration thing. But maybe I also know that the rules for this year are a little different still because of COVID, and don't know what exactly they're reverting back to the theatrical only model, if indeed they ever do. So right now it's on Apple Plus.
Yeah. The director is named, I think I'm pronouncing it right, Sion Heater is her name.
I don't know.
And she's from Massachusetts, so she's giving the like a lot of local flavor. You can always tell when a filmmaker is like familiar with the set and the location because they you can see a lot more specific local color leaking its way into the story. That's definitely true here. A lot of the details about this fishing village, the details of how docks work and how fishermen the day works for a fisherman is all very specific, and it appears to me to be accurate, even though I'm not a fisherman. Just everything about this, everything about like the little tiny details, all of the big emotional beats, including the big deliciously corny ending, all just punches through really, really well. Gets through all of that cynical wall of all of these formulas that you're so used to seeing and manages to get under your skin and actually work really well. I think all of these people deserve Academy Awards for their roles.
Wow.
This is really great acting.
Not just nominations, just the awards.
Emilia Jones is really great. I love Troy Kotsur. He's sort of the embarrassing dad. He's like the sort of grizzled bearded guy who, when our main character takes a date home just to sort of show him around her bedroom, is like, and this is where I live, and we're home alone right now. And then they suddenly hear their parents having very noisy sex in the other room. They're both deaf, so they can't bang on the door. So it's just to like crack the door open and like flick the lights on and off really fast. Like, I can't do that anymore. I have company here. It's like, well, we didn't know. Couldn't you stop? Have you seen your mom? How am I supposed to stop myself? Like, They're just like
they're fun,
hearty, exciting people to be around, and they're filmed in such a wonderful way.
That's great.
So yeah, really, really highly recommend Coda.
All right, well, moving on, and there's no good segue here, because I'm about to talk about a Hong Kong action movie called Raging Fire, starring Donnie Yen and directed by the late great Benny Chan. Benny Chan has been working in the action movie industry since the 80s, and he directed a lot of movies, not a lot of, like, breakout films in America. Probably his best-known films in America are Jackie Chan's Who Am I?, which is Jackie Chan wakes up with amnesia and he's trying to figure out his identity, and it ends with one of the best climaxes of any Jackie Chan movie, even though the movie itself, not my favorite. He also did Jackie Chan's New Police Story, which I feel is a bit underrated. The original Police Story movies are, like, these kind of like unassailable action classics, but the new one got a little overlooked, but I think the movie's really, really great. He was diagnosed with cancer while making his last movie, and he wasn't able to... He finished directing it, but he gave it away in post. Mm. So this is his last motion picture. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Formulaic, but pretty cool. It stars Donnie Yen as a hero cop. He's got a child on the way. He's trying to do everything by the book. At the beginning of the movie, he's ready to do a big drug bust, and he's invited up to have lunch with the top brass. They want to see him about something, and it turns out that he had arrested and filed a police report for a rich man's son who had assaulted a police officer. And they're just like, listen, we all want this to go away. The police officer who's been assaulted is right here. He's having lunch with us. He doesn't want to press any charges anymore. So we're just gonna make this go away. We just want that to be... You're cool with that, right? And Donnie Yen's like, I already filed the police report. It's been unfiled. And he's like, well, I should file that again then. And they're like, you don't want to do that. And then he like... It's this giant smorgasbord of food, and he's just like, how much is this tea I've been drinking? And he's just like, yeah, it's like $200,000 a pot. And he's like, okay, I had two sips, here's $200, I hope that covers it, good day to you. And he's so they're trying to show that he's a good cop. He'll also beat the shit out of people later without due process, but it's a cop movie.
Yeah, that's what action stars get to do. They get to commit acts of violence in the moral right.
Again, we need to we started more in like earnest last year, and we need to stop not like forget to have this conversation about the way that we treat cops in movies, as though, and this is another one of those where it's like, oh, internal affairs is like on my ass for all this stuff I've been doing, but doing everything the right way is just so inconvenient when all I have to do is bust down walls and break heads in order to save the day. And I'm like, yeah, there's a reason we don't like do that. There's a reason for that, because it's a very slippery slope down to corruption. This is a movie about police corruption, so
we saw that in an episode of Batman, like the 66 Batman. Yeah. It's like, well, we can leave you alone in the room with the suspect Batman for a few minutes.
Yeah,
rough him up a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like just common practice. We usually do that. It's like a show for kids.
I know, but like in the 60s, before Miranda rights were a thing, there was rampant police corruption. There's just like there is now, but a different kind. So the plot of the movie is Donnie Yen is trying to capture a new gang of criminals, but the twist is this gang of criminals who killed all... So basically Donnie Yen says no to the corrupt cop fiasco at the beginning, and because of that, he's taken off of this big drug bust he was supposed to do tonight, him and his whole team. And they're very pissed. They've been working on this for years. And sure enough, a new gang of criminals comes in the middle of this drug bust and kills everybody, including all the cops. So it's really fucked up. And it turns out that the new gang of criminals is all corrupt cops who recently got out of jail. They were basically told by the top brass, there's a rich guy who's been kidnapped. You need to do literally anything. We will have your back. Doesn't matter what you do. He needs to be rescued before the stock market opens tomorrow. That needs to happen. So anything you do, totally legal. Just do it, and they end up killing a guy.
Oh, jeez.
Donnie Yen, who wasn't privy to this deal, sees them do that, testifies against them. Everyone who said, we have your back, doesn't have their back anymore, and now they have been thrown to the wolves. So they spent years in prison. They're all, like, horribly scarred because, like, all the prisoners, the cops in prison. It doesn't go well for them. And now they have a long, elaborate plan to go on a crime wave and fuck shit up. It's not a bad premise. It's basically the movie Heat if Robert De Niro was an ex-cop. You might notice that the movie's called Raging Fire.
Which gives off a lot of heat, would you say?
It's not like credited as a remake, and enough has changed that it's not. But I'm pretty sure Benny Chan and his folks were fans of the movie Heat, because there's a lot of that vibe here. The movie itself falls back on a lot of cop cliches. It just does. There's good cop, bad cop. Yeah. There's a lot of speechifying. There's like, you can only hold me for 48 hours. And like, you know, that kind of thing is a plot point. And
Does the chief stand up and say you're off the case?
A couple of times.
Oh, God.
Yeah, like it's really formulaic. And that really is to the movie's detriment. However, when the action kicks in, holy shit. It's not wall-to-wall action. It's not like the Raid Redemption or anything where it's basically everything is an excuse for a giant action sequence. It's one of those action movies where it's actually like a pretty serious cop story, but whenever the action kicks in, it's supercharged. So, all right. There's this really cool bit where, Donnie Yen has to, talk to, a drug kingpin, but he doesn't have anything on him, so he just sort of storms the place by himself, he's just surrounded by dudes with, knives and sticks, and he's got to find a way to get out of that situation, and that's full of great stunts. There's an amazing motorcycle chase shootout, which does something really interesting that I'm actually surprised I haven't seen more of in action movies, and I'm going to struggle to describe this without visual aids, but we're used to, in action movies, a lot of action happening left to right. Mm. We'll call that the X-axis. Okay? Yeah. There's an action sequence in this movie that takes place almost exclusively on the Y-axis. Mm. From the foreground to the background and vice versa.
Okay.
It's actually really cool looking. It's really cool. It's really dynamic. Mm. It's a combination of shootout stuff and car chase stuff. And it's a very different way to film an action sequence, and it's very, very nifty, and I highly recommend checking that out, if nothing else.
That dynamic you're talking about has come to the fore with the ubiquity of telephones. As people film things vertically, they're beginning to rethink the way they stage a shot.
Yeah, use depth, exactly. Mm. So, there's a lot of that here. That bit's really fucking cool. It ends with a big heat type shootout, which is pretty fucking cool. Mm. It's an above average cop movie taken down by its formulaic qualities. But the action is so good that I do recommend you see it.
Okay. Well, if it's one of those things where they're going to pad out the action with a few scenes of exposition.
Yeah.
With the knowledge that we're only here for the action, that can be tolerated. If it's so insubstantial that they're using all of their energy to focus on the action, then we understand why we're here. We're here to see the action, and
but this isn't
we're only
quite
using
that.
The plot as pretense.
This isn't quite that. Right. This is more to compare it to two John Woo movies.
Hmm.
Okay, if you've seen Hard Boiled,
hmm.
Hard Boiled is an excuse for action. The plot makes no sense whatsoever, except in the big sweeping broad bullet points. They're all bullet points. It's
John Woo, but
regardless, it's all an excuse to get to the next big setup. The plot really isn't important. That's all it is. It's all mood and tone and a couple of characters, and then shoot. Motorcycle blows up in midair. Shoot. Mm. Hospital explodes. All kinds of crazy shit. But then you get to something like some of his earlier stuff, A Better Tomorrow, which is more of a serious cop noir. Hmm. But whenever there is a shootout, it does look fucking amazing. That's more like this. Okay. This is more of a serious cop movie, and that's why it being formulaic does drag it down a bit. I'm not sure I'm going to give it a C+ because of that. But the action is a C+.
Okay.
And I've seen better action. It's not the greatest action I've ever seen, but I've seen so many American action movies that are getting by with just being fine, or shooting an action sequence just okay, that to see one where it's some people actually do know how to film this right, consistently, it's such a breath of fresh air. Mm. It's really great.
Yeah. I've seen so many chases and so many action pictures, and I'm so bored by them because it's
hard to do them differently.
It's when the movie and the engagement and the story and all of the interesting things about the film stop, and we kind of just sort of give way to a lot of movement, and that's not so interesting to me.
Yeah.
So if you're going to make an action picture, you really have to go the extra mile. And I'm not just talking about now. I'm just talking in general.
Yeah.
Do something utterly spectacular.
Yeah.
Don't waste my time.
That's why I feel like a lot of the best action filmmakers stage their action not like an action sequence. They'll stage it like a musical number or a comedy scene. That's one of the brilliant things about Jackie Chan, was as he started to come into his own and have more creative control over his projects, he let his comedy influences get bigger and bigger and bigger until he was doing basically elaborate Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton routines. And, a lot of times you'll see a lot of... I think of one American filmmaker who actually I think gets it right is
Ralph McQuarrie.
Christopher McQuarrie. Ralph McQuarrie did the
Star Wars guy.
Star Wars sketch.
McQuarrie, who does the Mission Impossible films.
And Christopher McQuarrie did Rogue Nation. He did what was the other one he did?
Ghost Protocol.
Ghost Protocol was Brad Bird.
Oh, you're right.
The sixth one was
Fallout.
I want to say Flashpoint. It was wrong. It's another Donnie Yen movie. Yeah, he did that one Jack Reacher movie, and every single time he does an action sequence, he's pushing it, or he's trying to find a new way to do it. This goes back to his first directorial film, Way of the Gun, which is one of the most creative car chases I've ever seen in a movie. It's a slow-speed car chase I've never seen.
Because you bring it up constantly, it's not one that sticks in my head as well as it did with you.
It's structurally flawed.
All right.
It is a structurally flawed motion picture, but there's like two or three set pieces which I would teach in a class. They're just so interestingly put together. There's a slow-speed car chase that is incredibly suspenseful. And the final shootout is just exquisitely put together. And a few other things as well. But in any case, yeah, that's a filmmaker who is trying to find a way to use the action sequences to tell the story, but also understanding that when the action sequence is here, we're pausing everything to have a wild time and to really see what's happening and to appreciate what's happening. And understanding what's happening is more exciting than understanding that there was chaos and now the chaos is over, which is something that I think even good American action movies sometimes fall prey to. Like, I'm looking at you, Paul Greengrass, Jason Bourne movies.
Or even just like a lot of those Avengers movies, like you can get up during the action sequence and come back at the end of it and not miss much.
Every once in a while you'll get an exciting one, but the ending of Ant-Man is very clever.
There's a few funny bits where Thomas the Train becomes a life-size train out in the street all of a sudden. That's pretty fun.
All that stuff's really, really cool. Yeah. But a lot of times it's just. The worst offender of that was the X-Men movies, because half of them end with people pushing their hands out and shooting energy at another person, and then that person shoots a different color energy back.
The two energies meet in the middle and they're just blasting at each other.
You're really constipated.
It's the stupidest crap.
I hate it so much. But anyway, I digress. Formulaic action movie with really good... Formulaic cop movie with really good action. I did like it, but it's not. It's not like one last great classic from Benny Chan. And then lastly, Days.
Speaking of action-packed blockbusters, this is the latest film from Tsai Ming-Liang, who is a Taiwanese film director, and I had always been sort of familiar with the name. It's been floated around a lot of critical circles, but I only really discovered Tsai Ming-Liang this year, largely thanks to the other podcast I do with B. Peterson, All About Ovid, because there were a few Tsai Ming-Liang films on that platform, including his first, Rebels of the Neon God, which is a film he made back in the 90s and is excellent. Also, The Hole, which is one he made in 99 and is also excellent. I saw a film of his recently, which is a conversation between he and Li Kangsheng, an actor who has appeared in all of his movies, including this one, Days. And now this is his latest one. And this is... Tsai Ming-Liang, if you're not familiar with him, deals with... the other film of his I saw was Goodbye, Dragon Inn, which is maybe one of the best films about films and about movie theaters and about, the poetry of going to a cinema. Tsai Ming-Liang's films all deal with disconnect. They're all about loneliness. His characters tend to live in crowded spaces, but are desperate to connect to another person in some sort of profound way. And the little tiny conversations people can have, Tsai Ming-Liang tends to film them as weird miniature catharses that actually are the very fabric of life. Days begins with a shot of his lead actor, Li Kangsheng, sitting in a chair, looking out on rain. Rain is a big recurring motif. There's a lot of, in Tsai Ming-Liang's films, it's a lot of dampness, a lot of flooded spaces. And he is sitting there, he's kind of expressionless, very stone-faced. We just sort of hear the water. It's a single static shot and it lasts about 5 minutes. And something about the way Tsai Ming-Liang has framed that shot and the way the part is played, we are now in the space with him. And we are feeling his loneliness. There's a shot of him in a tub that lasts a long time. Then we cut to a different character, who's played by an actor named Anong Huanghuang Si. And he is seen in an equally kind of drab interior. Everything looks a little bit run down, like paint peels, the walls are cracked in Simon Lang's films, and he's preparing dinner. He prepares vegetables in what appears to be real time. He's like, you know, picking beans, and he's shaving we're in other no vegetables. Rush. Yeah, we're just sort of in the space with him. And these two characters are alone. The centerpiece of the film is when they meet. They meet in a hotel room, pretty drab hotel room, and the Li Kangsheng character lays on a bed naked, and he gets a massage, which starts out sort of therapeutic and turns very sexual by the end. And it's, again, it's like two incredibly long, single sustained shots where we get to see the flow of their sexual encounter, these two men in this hotel room. And this is clearly a financial transaction, but there's something very humane and humanly intimate happening between these two characters. And when they finished, the Li Kangsheng character gives the other character a music box. Now, and he, like a, one of those little ones with a little crank, and you crank it and you listen to a little tune. I had to look it up, but the tune that they play is the theme song to the Charlie Chaplin movie Limelight.
Oh, okay.
So we get a little bit of...
That's not Smile. That's from an earlier Chaplin film. General Ragos.
It's not a film I've seen, but I looked up a little bit about Limelight, and evidently loneliness is a big theme of that movie as well.
Yeah.
The production was very, very long on this, and Simon Lang, however, really wanted to sort of explore something that's incredibly valuable about life in the big city, and that is that sort of disaffection, this disconnect we have from the people around us, and how these connections that we make, however casual or sexual or financially motivated they might be, can fold us together in eternal and profound ways. Days is a work of extreme beauty. It is, however, also it's a test because there are a lot of sustained still shots of someone asleep in a bed. They're asleep. There's no action whatsoever. There's no music. And we just have single static shots of what it is to be in these spaces. And I appreciate a filmmaker who is willing to create the space and let us sit in it for a while.
Yeah.
Let us have these areas where we can exist and feel and contemplate and meditate and get into a new kind of emotional heart space. Simon Lang is maybe one of the great masters. I've talked a lot this year about Alav Diaz, another filmmaker. He's a Filipino filmmaker, and he's known for slow cinema.
Right.
And I read an article recently about how slow cinema doesn't tend to come out of the United States, and how geography might have a lot to do with the kinds of pacing in the stories we tell. America is very devoted to hustle. There's a lot of movement, a lot of action. We're sort of just culturally addicted to big moments and forward momentum and change. Yeah. Whereas in other parts of the world, maybe less so. So we're getting slow cinema from outside of this country.
Well, it kind of makes sense when we do create something in America that does feel maybe not slow cinema, but on the slower side, it tends to be more pastoral.
Yeah, so you get Terrence Malick, for instance.
Yeah, something that feels more rural most of the time.
And where is Terrence Malick from? He's from rural Texas. So his geography has definitely informs what he tells his stories about.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call Simon Lang one of those slow cinema filmmakers, but this is as close as he's ever come.
Well, you can use the same techniques or similar techniques to evoke things without just doing that thing. Mm. Like, Guy Madden evokes silent cinema even when he's not making silent cinema. Mm. You know, he's not a silent filmmaker, but he's using those techniques to create a specific effect.
That film stock, the intertitles,
Yeah, those visual effects, exactly. So, yeah, if he's using those elements in a slightly different way, fair enough, yeah. Mm. Well, you saw some good movies this week.
Yeah, they were all pretty good this week. Nice. I really, really loved Days, and I really, really loved Coda. I recommend both of those.
I did not have all right, let's review some movies. Mm. So, at the end of every episode, we review our movies on the critically acclaimed scale, just in case you weren't entirely sure where we landed on them. Our critically acclaimed scale runs from C- to C+. Most movies are a C. You've been to school. A C is average. C- is below average. That's everything from we just kind of don't recommend it to the worst movie ever made. And C+ is above average, which is everything from we just recommend it to this is the greatest movie of all time. Mm. On that note, Days.
Days is a C+. Nice. Please seek this out. It's one of the more impressive cinema achievements you'll see this year. Wow. It's going to take a lot of patience.
Okay.
It's going to take a lot of engagement. Again? It's a little over 2 hours.
Okay, so it's not...
It's not one of those five-hour monsters.
Epic. Okay, yeah. But still, the time commitment. Yeah. Okay. All right. Raging Fire. It's a very high C. Fact that it feels like, you know, 8 other really good cop movies draws it down a little bit, and it's kind of unaware of its, like, central hypocrisy because it's trying to evoke those very Western motifs. But when it works really well. And the action kicks ass. Mm. So I definitely can't give it a bad review, but it's definitely something holding back from making it truly awesome. But if you like cop movies, if you like action movies, I do recommend checking it out. It's a cool watch. Mm. Let's see here. Coda.
Coda, also C+. Okay. I was kind of raving about it a little bit, but yeah, I really, really loved Coda. This is Hollywood melodrama in a lot of ways, but it gives us a new angle. Mm-hmm. It gives us and it just does everything correctly, and that's refreshing and grand in its own way. So yeah, C+.
Don't Breathe 2 is a C-. It's not without its finer qualities. Again, I think the cast is very, very good. It looks very, very good. There's some cool, exciting bits in it. But it's all revolving around an idea that, unfortunately, isn't very well developed. Mm-hmm. They seem to want to take the villain and make him the hero without really doing the work. Or rather, maybe it was misguided and this guy is just too difficult to turn into a proper hero. Mm-hmm. Even under the film's own terms, which are still really, really dark. So it's a misfire, maybe an interesting misfire, but I don't think it's effective, and that's a damn shame, because I still think the original is terrifying. And then lastly, Free Guy.
Free Guy, a high C.
Okay.
This is frustratingly not as deep as it could have been. I wanted it to go, like, a little bit more Star Trek in terms of its plot and its grandness, but it's still a fun watch. It's actually incredibly genial and energetic and really, really funny. Right. You could do a lot less worse with your time. I know that's not a useful statement whatsoever.
Put it on the poster. Yeah. You could do a lot less worse with your time. Whitney Seibold. That's it. So thank you everybody for listening to Critically Acclaimed this week. We'll be back next week with more movie reviews. Mm. What's coming out next week? There's that new Hugh Jackman psychological thing, Reminiscence.
The Reminiscence, science fiction thing about it's like Total Recall, playing with memories.
A couple new horror films from Neil Blomkamp and David Bruckner.
Paw Patrol is coming out next week.
Paw Patrol, which has really good reviews so far.
I'm going to see that Paw Patrol movie.
Really, really good reviews.
I'm familiar
with 100% Rotten Tomatoes for a while. It might still be.
Well, okay. Well, let's see.
Yeah.
That rarest of things, a G-rated film. So let's see what the G rating is.
It'd be nice if it's great. Maybe it sucks. We'll have to check it out. But anyway, interesting. And maybe other things besides. And So thank you everybody for listening. If you want to help out the show, you can, of course, subscribe, leave us a review. That always helps us in the algorithm. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows about Batman, Star Trek, the Academy Awards. We just released a commentary track for the two-part Simpsons episode, Who Shot Mr. Burns? We also have a crossover episode with our friends at Linoleum Knife. If you head on over to the Linoleum Knife podcast, that's Dave White and Alonzo Duralde, two of the best film critics in the world. That is not an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. It's weird that they let us do podcasts with them sometime.
Dave White, one of the hosts, was on an episode of All About Ovid talking about Siming Lang with B and I. So,
see, impeccable taste.
So yeah. Listen to that episode too. Yeah. To hear us talk more about Siming Lang.
But we had a crossover episode with them on our Patreon last month, and this month we have a crossover episode on their Patreon over at Linoleum Knife. In this case, Alonzo and I dragged Whitney and Dave kicking and screaming to watch the latest Hannah Swenson bakery murder movie over at Hallmark.
We weren't really kicking and screaming. We were just sort of dragging our feet with our heads lowered.
You know what you're in. You know this is what you signed up for.
As you thrashed us about the back with your whips. Get in there. Get and watch those movies.
But we actually had a fun conversation about this one.
Comforting and has cookies in it.
You poor soul. You had to be comforted and be reminded that cookies are nice. Oh God, you horrible!
It hurt so bad.
You poor creature. Whatever shall you do?
Trickly warmth. It's like drinking molten Hummel figurines.
Anyway, it's a fun, funny episode, and I think it's available as of when this podcast is up. So please head on over there to check that out. That's on their Patreon page. We're also on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
Don't forget, if you want to hear Whitney talk about more artsy fartsy stuff of the highest caliber, okay, artsy
double artsy and twice as fartsy.
You can check out All About Ovid, which he hosts with the great B. Peterson. Where can they find that?
I think it's just on the Patreon page. Although B has been releasing all of the Patreon exclusive content just out in public, mm-hmm. just so more people can hear it. It's patreon.com/thescreensmargins. That's mm-hmm. the name of B's mm-hmm. network. And yeah, we've been talking about just whatever we get to on all of it. Our last episode was about Patricio Guzman, Chilean filmmaker.
Nice. That's great. Yeah. And of course, we also have a soap store, Salt Cat Soap, over on Etsy. We have a bunch of new designs for this month. Someone pointed out, and I feel ridiculous for not thinking about this, considering I'm supposed to be like the geeky one. One of our soaps for this month looks just like the Tesseract from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So you can get a Tesseract soap, and it smells great.
Did they ever call it the Cosmic Cube? Because that's what they called it in the movie.
I always thought there was a nice poetry to the Cosmic Cube, but I feel like they maybe mentioned it once.
Cosmic Cube feels like a placeholder. Like they just drew a cube. With, like you got to think of like whatever the widget was later. And then they just decided to go with the cube.
There's something kind of pure about a cube. You know, it's like a very simple, very powerful geometric image. And a Tesseract, I don't even know what that looks like. It's not a cube. It's not a cube.
In the movies, it is a cube.
I know, but it's not supposed to be a cube.
Don't they break it open and there's something inside? Or
no, you're thinking of the mind gem. It was like there was like the Loki's staff had the mind gem and they had to crack it open and there was a thing.
Oh, okay.
Maybe. No, you're right, because there was actually like that's how it fit on the Thanos' glove. You're right.
That's right. There was like a little thing inside.
Yeah, with your free prize inside.
I know a lot of people watch those movies repeatedly, so there's a lot of details that are really well known to a large contingent of those movies fans that I just have no memory of whatsoever. Because I've seen the movies once. I don't go back and watch those films.
That's fine. I've seen a couple of them more than once, but mostly no.
So I recall little details from here and there. Like somebody at some point crushed a glowing cube, and there was a little smaller thing inside. And that's all I remember.
It's good times.
Doctor Strange crushed a cube and killed Vision.
Sure.
I remember that scene. I remember where
I don't think it was Doctor Strange who did it, but anyway.
The robot's head got crushed. That was pretty cool.
It was fun for everybody. Anyway, moving on. So that's it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you everybody for listening, and never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?